One of my favorite chapters in the Gospel of John is the 9th chapter, because it tells us the story of the blind man's healing. And we spent our time in the 9 o'clock hour talking about what happened. Jesus was passing by. He saw a man blind from birth. And Jesus provided healing. And after that healing, this man's neighbors began to question him about how that his sight had been restored. And he explained what had happened. That was troubling to his neighbors because this occurred on the Sabbath. And so they took this man to the Pharisees. And the Pharisees questioned him. And once again, the blind man explained what had happened. They're not satisfied with his explanation, and so they go find his parents, and they interrogate his parents. They want to know, is this your son? Was he born blind? How does he now see? Well, the parents acknowledge that he's their son and that he now sees. They refuse to acknowledge how that had transpired. And so once again, the Jewish leaders interrogate the blind man. And finally, in exasperation, they cast him out. Jesus hears about all of that. He goes and he seeks out the blind man, and he has some questions of his own. And the Pharisees ask Jesus this question in verse 40, are we blind also? And that question is what I want each one of us to think about for a few minutes this morning. There are several actors in this little drama. There is the blind man, of course. And there are the apostles who ask Jesus an important question. And then there's the neighbors who questioned the healed blind man. And the Pharisees who interrogate the blind man and then his parents and then the blind man once again. And so the parents have their part to play in this story. And finally, the Pharisees. Are we blind also? Well, may I suggest to you that I think there's just a lot of blind people in this story. And I want to talk to you about their blindness. And we begin, of course, with the blind man. He was congenitally blind. But I want you to notice that in this story, he moves from physical blindness to physical sight, and then finally to spiritual insight. In fact, he may be the only one in the story who really sees the important things that needed to be seen. May I point out to you that in the 11th verse, we are told that in the beginning, the blind man knew that a man named Jesus had healed him. But later, when questioned by the Pharisees, he declares his belief that Jesus is a prophet, verse 17. And then later, in verses 31 through 33, he declares that Jesus must have been a man from God. And then in verses 35 through 38, he comes to see Jesus as the Son of Man and Lord, and we are told that he worshiped Jesus. Now, may I ask you, what about you? When you look at Jesus, what do you see? Do you see Jesus as not just a prophet or a man of God, but as the Son of Man, the Son of God, and Lord? You see, the blind man experienced congenital blindness from birth, but he moves from that to great spiritual insight. But then there were the apostles. They asked Jesus the question as they were passing by the blind man, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And we talked a bit about this in the 9 o'clock hour, but please notice that when the apostles saw the blind man, they didn't ask, "Why was this man born blind?" Instead, they asked, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" You see, there was a presupposition behind their question. And that presupposition was that all physical suffering is the result of personal sin. And may I suggest to you that I believe that the apostles, when they asked this question, were blinded by their own preconceived ideas. This was the same problem that Job's friends had when they came to comfort Job. When they tried to explain Job's terrible predicament, their answer can be summarized like this. Their view was, well, piety pays and perversity punishes. That was their explanation for Job's suffering. They thought, "Job, you must be guilty of some terrible, heinous sin for all of this calamity to fall upon you." And Job maintained that that was not the case. May I suggest to you that this preconception that the apostles had is still a preconception that some people have even today. I have mentioned that when I was a young boy, my dad did a lot of appointment preaching. This was in the 60s. He would preach at one little country church one Sunday and another little country church another Sunday. And I don't really remember which church it was, but I remember that we went home with Sammy and Fern Holland one Sunday afternoon. I was too young to be a part of the discussion that my dad had with them, but I remember him talking about it later. You see, they had a young toddler who kind of got away and got down to the pond and went in the pond and drowned. And Sammy and Fern spent Sunday afternoon talking with my dad about who sinned. They had the idea that they must have been guilty of some terrible sin for this to happen to their loved one. And my dad spent Sunday afternoon talking with them, trying to show them that physical suffering is not always the direct result of personal sin. Now, it is certainly true that all suffering is the indirect result of sin, namely, the sin of Adam and Eve in the fall. Brothers and sisters, we live on a cursed earth because Adam and Eve sinned in the very beginning. God told them that as a consequence, the ground would be cursed, and so it would bring up thorns and thistles, and by the sweat of your brow, you'll earn your bread, God said to Adam. And he told Eve that she would bring forth children in pain. And ladies, I suspect you'll agree with what I'm about to say. when God zaps a curse on somebody, he knows how to do a pretty good job of that. And every woman since then has been living with the consequence of Adam and Eve's sin in the very beginning. And so it's true that all of the suffering that we experience in life is the indirect result of what happened in the fall. But folks, it is not true that all suffering is the direct result of personal sin. Some suffering is. In Proverbs, the 23rd chapter, the wise man asked the question, who has woe? Well, I knew I shouldn't start that. So let me just turn there quickly. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaints? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? And you remember what he says next, I'm sure. He says, those who linger long at the wine, those who go in search of mixed wine. And then he continues that discussion. It is certainly true that the drunkard will experience physical suffering as a result, many times, of his drunkenness. And may I remind you that Miriam, Moses' sister, was struck with leprosy temporarily because she had questioned Moses' authority. And in John chapter 5, when Jesus healed the paralytic at the pool of Bethesda, he told him after that healing, go and sin no more. Perhaps his paralysis was in some way directly related to some sin. We can't know that for sure, but it's certainly a possibility. And brothers and sisters, the children among the Israelites who wandered in the wilderness for 40 years because of their parents' unbelief, they suffered the consequences of that. And when the northern kingdom of Israel was carried away by the Assyrians and the southern kingdom of Judah carried away by the Babylonians, there were some righteous people in that number, like Daniel and Ezekiel and others, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. All suffering is not the direct result of personal sin. And I can illustrate this point, and I've done this in the past, by mentioning the names of several Bible characters that all begin with the letter J. Job, Joseph, John the Baptist, Jesus, James the son of Zebedee. How many of you believe that if you do good, you will get good things in life, and if you do bad, you will get bad things in life? Generally speaking, how many of you believe that? Raise your hand. Some of you are slow. All right, second question. How many of you believe that if you are good, nothing bad will ever happen to you, and if you're bad, nothing good will ever happen to you? Raise your hands. I don't see any hands. We don't believe that, do we? You see, the disciples were just partially right. They tried to use a generality to explain everything, but it doesn't explain everything. Why did the disciples ask Jesus the question, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents? Well, it's because that was the conventional thinking of their day. That's what they'd heard from the Jewish rabbis. That's what had been handed down to them. But what about you? Is it possible that you might be blinded like the apostles by preconceived ideas? It's probably impossible for us to be completely unbiased. because we all come to the Scriptures with certain baggage. We come to the Scriptures with our own background. So while it may be impossible for us to be 100% unbiased, we need to recognize the fact that preconceived ideas can blind us to the truth. And we need to strive for as much objectivity as we can. We need to examine our heart and our motives. As John tells us in 1 John 4, we need to try the spirits to see whether they are from God or not. And like the Bereans, we need to search the Scriptures daily. But I hope you can see that in the question that the apostles asked Jesus, there is evidence that they were blinded by their preconceived ideas that all suffering is the direct result of sin. And then there were the neighbors. We are told that they were asking questions among themselves. Verse 8, some asked, "Is not this he who sat and begged?" And some of them said, "This is he." Others said, "He is like him." And he says, "I am he. I'm the guy." But what I hope you can see is that there were some among the neighbors who were not immediately ready and willing to accept the obvious. Why not? Well, I believe it's because they were blinded by what I'm going to call anti-supernaturalism. In other words, they had difficulty in believing a miracle. They had difficulty in recognizing someone whom they had seen countless times, who was blind but now was able to see. And folks, there are people today who are blinded by anti-supernaturalism. Are you aware of the fact that there are critics who say that Daniel did not write the book of Daniel? That you've got several different, quote, Daniels. Some say that part of the book was written by what they call a Maccabean Daniel. And that part of the book was written during the intertestamental period, during the silent centuries. You know why they say that? They say that because the book of Daniel contains predictive prophecy that is very minute in its detail, and these folks don't believe in predictive prophecy. And so since you have predictions in the book of Daniel, but predictive prophecy can't happen, Daniel couldn't have written the book. Somebody else had to write those portions of the book. This problem of anti-supernaturalism rears its ugly head with the Jesus Seminar. Have you heard of the Jesus Seminar? Anybody heard of the Jesus Seminar? Well, it's a group of scholars who meet, I think, once a year, and this started, I guess, back in the 80s, maybe the early 90s, and they met for years. I'm not sure if they're still meeting, but their goal was to figure out just who the historical Jesus was and just exactly what Jesus really said and really did. And they laid out 64 premises and 37 rules of evidence to set about judging the authenticity of Jesus' statements in the Gospel of Mark. And among these principles were these. I'm quoting now. The historical Jesus is to be distinguished from the gospel portraits of him. Did you catch that? They're saying that the historical Jesus, the real guy, is different from the guy that we read about in the gospels. Furthermore, only a small portion of the sayings attributed to Jesus in the gospels was actually spoken by him. In other words, Jesus didn't say most of the things that are in red letters in your New Testaments. They go on to say quoted speech that is entirely context-bound is probably the product of the storyteller. So it's the storyteller that put these words into the mouth of Jesus. And statements attributed to the risen Jesus are not admissible as evidence for the historical Jesus. Do you know why they came up with all those rules and regulations? It's because they don't believe in miracles. And 50 of the so-called secular scholars meet in semi-annual meetings in Santa Rosa, California, and they carry on lively discussions, and they cast votes. They've got these different colored beads. And so they'll throw a red bead in the pot, and that indicates an authentic saying of Jesus. And a pink bead indicate something that Jesus might have said or done. A gray bead indicates material that is probably inauthentic. And a black bead indicates something that Jesus definitely did not say and did not do. And you know what they decided? They concluded that no more than 20% of the sayings and even fewer of the deeds attributed to Jesus are authentic. And so they've rejected the Lord's Prayer, the seven sayings on the cross, Jesus' claims to divinity, the virgin birth, most of Jesus' miracles. They've rejected the resurrection. But folks, they started their quest to uncover the historical Jesus with a set of skeptical philosophical presuppositions. Number one, miracles do not happen. Number two, the early church fabricated much of the Jesus tradition. Number three, the biblical text evolved as they passed from oral to written form. Number four, the texts were redacted. That means edited, to reflect the various theological agendas of the many editors. You know what their problem is? They have an anti-supernatural bias. And that's the problem that the evolutionists have. Y'all heard of the science fiction writer Isaac Asimov? Some of you have. Some of you need to get out more. You were supposed to laugh. Listen to what he says. Emotionally, I am an atheist. I don't have the evidence to prove that God doesn't exist, but I so strongly suspect he doesn't that I don't want to waste my time. Sir Arthur Keith, a British evolutionist, said, "Evolution is unproven and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable." Do you see how relevant the question, "Are we blind?" also is in our day and age? And then there's the Pharisees. And they were blinded by their own man-made tradition. Now, we shouldn't think that the word tradition is a dirty word. It just simply means something handed down. And the Lord's Supper is a tradition handed down to the early church and to us from Jesus' apostles. You see, tradition can be either good or bad depending upon where it came from. You see, it's the unauthorized traditions of men that are contrary to the will of God that will get us into trouble. Folks, it wasn't God's tradition handed down to the Jews that Jesus violated. It was the Pharisees' man-made tradition. The Sabbath law in the Old Testament had said, don't kindle any fires, don't cook, don't leave your place, don't work, don't bear burdens, rest, remember the Lord. But God had not given the Jews an encyclopedic set of rules defining work. Now, what constituted work needed to be defined, but the Pharisees went to ridiculous extremes. But even they believed that some activity was permitted on the Sabbath. They believed that the priests could circumcise a male baby if the eighth day fell on the Sabbath. They believed that they could rescue an animal if it fell into a pit on the Sabbath. You see, the Pharisees condemned Jesus for healing on the Sabbath. But in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 12, in a different story, Jesus responded by saying that it was right to do good on the Sabbath. But many people are blinded by man-made tradition today. There are so many traditions about Mary, for example, that she was immaculately conceived, that she remained a virgin perpetually, that she should be worshipped or venerated, that her body was bodily assumed into heaven after she died, that she is a mediatrix between God and man. That means that she is a female mediator. That's what the Catholic Church teaches. That's what Catholics believe. And so they pray to Mary. But folks, none of that is in the New Testament. None of that has been handed down to us from God. Infant baptism, the burning of candles, incense, the use of rosary beads, the clergy-laity distinction, denominational hierarchy, all of that, you can't read that in this book. It hasn't been handed down by God. It is man-made tradition. But now, are you listening to me? Are you really listening to me? New Testament Christians can be blinded by tradition, just like anybody else. Steve Ramsey, who preached for a church in Texas when I was living out there in the 90s, lost his outside support because the church decided that they would only meet once on Sunday for 3 hours and not meet on Sunday evening. That should sound familiar to this church. Steve Ramsey came and preached one night in a lectureship. That's what they called gospel meetings in Texas, if you had different speakers each night. And he came to Wallaceville Road where I was preaching, and one of the men had a fit because he was wearing a beard. There has been controversy among Christians about what name you should put on the sign out front. Boy, I'm going to get in trouble, but I'm going to do it anyway. Jesus didn't give the church a name. Church of Christ is not a name. It's a description. And it just means the assembly that belongs to Christ. But New Testament writers also use the description Church of God and Church of the Firstborn. When I was young, I thought that meant the Church of Christ, the firstborn one. It doesn't mean that. It's plural. It's the Church of the Firstborn Ones. We can be blinded by man-made tradition just as much as were the Pharisees. And we need to be careful that we are binding only what God teaches in His Word. We must reject unauthorized tradition that we may have developed. We must be aware of the problem of permissible tradition that we have made mandatory. And we need to recognize that there is a difference in a possible, a reasonable, even a probable inference and an inescapable inference. What about us? Is it possible that we may have been blinded by man-made tradition? Do we have to end a service by offering an invitation? Do we have to end a service with a word of prayer? I must move along. And then there were the parents. And they were blinded by fear. I believe they knew that Jesus had healed their son, but they were not willing to own up to that, because the Jewish leaders had said, if you confess Jesus as the Christ, we're going to throw you out of the synagogue. In fact, fear of the Jews is a common theme in John's gospel. That's probably why Nicodemus came to Jesus by night. We can't know for sure, but that's where I'm leaning. That's why the people speculated privately about whether or not Jesus would come to Jerusalem during the Feast of Tabernacles. That's why in John chapter 12, some of the rulers who believed were not willing to confess their faith in Christ. And the same kind of thing can happen today. Do you think that folks have ever done things that they didn't really want to do, or fail to do things that they really knew they should do because they were afraid of being kicked out of the church. Has that ever happened, you reckon? Do this. The wise man says in Proverbs 29, verse 25, the fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord shall be safe. Isaiah writes in Isaiah 51, verse 7, listen to me, you who know righteousness, you people in whose heart is my law. Do not fear the reproach of men, nor be afraid of their insults. And then we got to look at the Pharisees one more time. Because not only were they blinded by tradition, they were blinded by arrogant certainty. Look at what the Pharisees do in all of this. They reject the clear evidence of their own eyes because it doesn't fit their man-made tradition. They decide that this man couldn't have been born blind. So they interrogate his parents, hoping to find some halfway plausible way to explain away the miracle. And when that doesn't work, they interrogate the blind man once again, hoping to find another plausible way to explain this miracle away. Look at the evidence of their arrogant certainty. Verse 16, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. Verse 24, we know that this man is a sinner. Verse 28, you are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. Verse 29, we know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from. Verse 34, you were completely born in sins, and are you teaching us? As my friend Gary Fisher likes to say, wow! Please note that these were religious people who said these things. The blind man's repeated and humble confessions of ignorance stand in stark contrast to the Pharisees' brash statements of certainty. Does that kind of thing ever happen today? Do folks ever take a position today because some Church of Christ preacher said it? Because this is what the Church of Christ believes. Do people ever assume that someone else couldn't possibly be right because he or she is not a member of the Church of Christ? I remember when I was a lad, somewhere between the age of 6 and 10, because that's when we lived in Louisville, Kentucky, we were outside playing with some of the neighbors, and I don't remember anything about it other than a Bible question came up, and I told my neighbor that she was wrong. I mean, I don't think I said it quite that forcefully, hopefully, but well, my mom was out at the kitchen sink and the window was up. It was warm enough for that, and she overheard what happened, and Mother called out and said, no, Kevin, she's right. And I thought to myself, thankfully I did not utter what I was thinking, but I thought to myself, she can't be right. She's a Catholic. Now, that's the thinking of a boy. I mean, don't be too hard in your judgment. But it illustrates my point, does it not? Let me tell you, folks, the Jehovah's Witnesses are not wrong about everything. And the Mormons are not wrong about everything. Now, they're wrong about a lot of things. But they're not wrong about everything. Do people ever reject a person's preaching and teaching because he doesn't have a whole bunch of theological degrees behind his name? Myrna was asking me just the other day if I had gone to a seminary, and I told her I hadn't. But the New Testament doesn't say you have to go to a seminary to be a preacher. A lot of people think you have to. But the New Testament doesn't say that. You know, it says a lot about Priscilla and Aquila that they were willing to take Apollos aside and teach him the way of the Lord more accurately in light of his knowledge and his eloquence. But you know something? It also says a lot about Apollos, who was willing to let them do that. Do churches ever reject preachers because they weren't educated in one of our colleges? You better believe that happens. Do folks ever go on the attack when they don't have an answer to your counterarguments? That's what the Pharisees did with the blind man. Oh, you are born in sin, and you're teaching us? Do people ever dismiss the teaching of others because they know that they're right and they couldn't possibly be wrong? The wise man says in Proverbs 26, verse 12, "Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There is more hope of a fool than for him." And Isaiah writes in Isaiah 5, 21, "Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3, verse 18, "Let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you seems to be wise in this age, let him become a fool, that he may become wise." A lot of blindness in this chapter. And aren't you glad I didn't try to preach it all in one sermon? The apostles were blinded by their preconceived ideas. Some of the neighbors were blinded by their anti-supernatural bias. The Pharisees were blinded by their man-made tradition. The parents were blinded by fear. And the Pharisees were blinded again by their arrogant certainty. Open our eyes that we may see. The blind man came to see Jesus for who he really was. And if you've not done that, I hope that you will. And if you've not submitted your will to him, I hope you'll do that. And you have an opportunity to do that this morning. You can make the decision to become a Christian if you've not made that decision. Or if you've not been living as you should live as a Christian, you can make the decision to change that. And we stand ready to help anyone who needs to seek God's forgiveness. You can do that now as we stand and we sing.